interesting irony to the removal of statues that honor historical figures whose biographies include terrible ideas or things. Pulling these monuments down may bring them more attention than they've had for decades, as they sat ignored in parks or public squares. So if people can pass these now objectionable displays all the time without even knowing who they depict or why, what motivates the iconoclasts who suddenly demand their destruction, and what changes after they're torn down? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Historian Samuel Biagetti is host of the podcast Historiansplaining and author of a recent essay for American Affairs that explores the surprising relationship between old and new ideas, existing and emerging power structures, and social and cultural change over time. The piece is called Iconoclasm of the Vanities: Why We Are Destroying Statues. Samuel, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So the removal of statues feels like a pretty recent development in political activism. In fact, you explain that humans have been doing this for maybe only slightly less time than we've been erecting statues.
Yes, I mean, it seems to go back basically as far back as we can see in recorded history. And there are many archaeological sites where you can see idols, statues, images that have been torn out of temples and broken to pieces. And it's only by comparing many, many instances all the way up through history that we can get a grasp on why people do this and why iconoclasms seem to break out almost in a cycle.
What might have driven the inhabitants of Easter Island to pull down some of the monuments there by the time the first English explorers landed in the 18th century?
Well, even before Europeans showed up, it seems, there was profound ecological change happening in Easter Island, and the palm forests that were sort of the base of the ecosystem and their livelihood on that island were dying out. And sometimes that's been blamed on the people. More recent scholarship thinks it was because of invasive rats. But basically, the way that people were accustomed to living by gardening, hunting, was no longer possible. And they lost confidence basically in the social order, the cosmic order, and the ancestors that those statues represented. They were intended to be inhabited by the souls of the ancestors. And if you look at them, they're set up on the shore facing inland, sort of watching the people of the island. And as, you know, the rug was sort of pulled out from under them and they had to somehow scramble to survive, they expressed their anger and their disillusionment at the ancestors by pulling the statues down and in some cases defacing them.
The term iconoclast is most often used as a metaphor today, right? To describe groundbreaking artists and thinkers, but the word itself is tied to the physical act of destroying images?
Yeah, it's from Greek, and it was first used in the Byzantine Empire to just mean breaking of images. And there's sort of another famous case where Byzantine officials went out through the countryside in the empire attacking and destroying icons of saints or holy men. And, you know, as I argue in the article, this is a good example of what tends to happen, which is one elite is competing with another elite and wants to displace them, to take up leadership, and to promulgate a new philosophy, a new ideology. And that's the sort of purpose that the iconoclasm serves.
So that's the predictable cycle of iconoclasm.
Yeah, and it's important to know that very often the targets of iconoclasm are images or objects that people aren't really paying that much attention to, that people can kind of ignore, that can fly under the radar. But attacking them and destroying them creates new images, right? The images of, you know, the crowd on the Bowling Green in New York pulling down the statue of King George. It's been seen and reproduced a million times. And today, of course, with the recent iconoclasm, they can be reproduced a million times on the internet, on television. And it sort of creates a new set of images, right? A new set of icons to represent the new philosophy, which then eventually have to be attacked and destroyed in the next wave, right? It's a cycle.
The King George one is a great example of this because, I mean, this was taken down in the very earliest days of the Revolutionary War. And probably, I mean, there were people scattered all over the colonies. Probably only people who lived within walking distance of this thing even knew about it before it was torn down.
Yeah, and New York was the second biggest town in the colonies. It was only like maybe 25,000 people at most. This was not and there was no photography. This was not an image a lot of people had encountered. But that woodcut that was made later in the 19th century of the people pulling it down, that is what has been multiplied ad infinitum a million times and has become kind of part of the iconography of America, and hence part of sort of our identity, our worldview. And I really think that that's the pattern that I found, is that iconoclasm is not just a rejection of the thing that the statue represents. Rather, it's an expression. It's a way of creating a new image and putting forward a new idea for a new leadership class.
I always love reading things that remind me of how little I actually know. And I have to tell you, I had always kind of stupidly assumed that the Sphinx didn't have a nose. Sphinx didn't have a nose because of like wear and tear over time. Pardon the pun, it was deliberately defaced by people.
Yes, and I first sort of got on the trail of this because I looked through the Egyptian gallery at the Brooklyn Museum, and very nicely they had a plaque explaining, you may notice that all of these Egyptian statues have their noses broken off, and that's not accidental. It's not because they were packed poorly. It's because when the people decided that a certain deity or a certain ancestral ruler no longer had authority, they broke the nose off in order to stop the spirit, in order to sort of deanimate the statue, to take away its spiritual power. And the nose, you know, is where the breath path passes through. So it's literally the spirit, the soul comes through the nose. And so I looked into the Sphinx, and this common story that we hear that, you know, Napoleon fired a cannon and broke it off for fun. That's all false. The earliest records say it was in the 15th century. An Islamic preacher was upset that people were bringing offerings to the Sphinx as if it was a live deity. And he vandalized and took the nose off to, in a sense, disempower it, deactivate it. And I think that it's an interesting illustration, again, of how when people attack statues, it's because they're attributing immense power, almost magical or spiritual power, to the statue, which they then decide to destroy.
Samuel, in some cases, physical symptoms of a powerful person or elite entity may not exist, and then iconoclasts actually build them for the purposes of destroying them. This is what's happening when somebody's burned an effigy.
Right. Yeah, it's remarkable. You know, you're in a small town, say on Cape Cod, and you don't have a statue of the king to tear down. So they would actually create forms and images of the king in order to then destroy it. And it often was very dramatic. You know, they would create an effigy, hang it on a tree, then cut it down, burn it, and bury the ashes in the ground. You know, and it was this intentionally dramatic, propagandistic act, again, to send a message.
So I'm sure that feels really good for the people who are doing this. What assumptions, though, do iconoclasts tend to make about the cultural importance of these symbols beforehand? Do they overestimate their power to actually influence public thought?
Well, I think that sometimes yes and sometimes no. I mean, there are different instances. Like if you're talking about the Byzantine iconoclasm, that was a real power struggle where, you know, the regional gentry really invested great importance in the holy men, the monks, and the icons who represented them. But in other societies, those images and forms have already really lost their power to influence people. And I think that that is the main thing that really struck me about the current iconoclasm, is these people who are tearing down these statues are acting as if the whole world cares about these statues, as if they have some sort of insidious power to control society. And I have quotations where people say things like this, that there's a whole power structure built into this bronze statue. And it's like, Nobody thinks that. No, for the most part, these are obscure. A lot of the figures who they targeted are obscure individuals. Most people have never heard of them, but they have to invest them with this tremendous power in order to then carry out the iconoclastic act. And I think that, to me, you know, this is part of why I called it Iconoclasm of the Vanities, which was just a title that came to me. And then retroactively, I was like, why did I call it that? And part of it is like, the apparent futility of it all. Like, What do you think this is accomplishing? You know, what difference do these statues make to ordinary, everyday Americans going about their lives? And it struck me really, especially in 2020, I said, out of everything that's going on, out of the disease and crime and poverty and war, you're going to direct all this fury at statues? Like this is your response? And I had to really puzzle through it. And that's really where this article came from.
Well, it's easier to take down a statue than to dismantle racism, right?
Yeah, I mean, that takes a lot more work. And also, you know, taking down statues is something that can go through the democratic process. You know, and a lot of this was touched off by the events in Charlottesville, which began because the Charlottesville City Council voted to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee. I mean, the democratic process can address these disputes and debates, but that doesn't have the same kind of charge. It doesn't have the emotional charge, the drama, the propagandistic charge. And it's easier to sort of stage a dramatic event, I think, than go through the kind of hard slog of actually changing laws and policies through the democratic process. And part of, again, what I'm trying to understand is how there's been this campaign of tearing down statues. Meanwhile, what policing laws have changed? Has there been any change to who hires and fires police, who disciplines police, how they operate? I don't think so. I think the it creates an illusion of change, right? It's a sort of shortcut to the appearance of change.
How do modern media like photography and video and now the internet affect the impact of acts of ritual destruction?
Well, one of the remarkable things I found is that I really couldn't find significant movements of iconoclasm in the 20th century. And it's the era of photography and cinema, it seems like it should be perfect for, you know, what we were describing, this sort of multiplication of iconoclastic images. And yet it really seems it didn't happen, and not until the early 2000s, you know, when I found there's the Taliban and the destruction of the Buddhas of Bamiyan and other destructions they carried out of images in Afghanistan. And then this iconoclasm in the US and Britain, you know, North America and Britain, that's broken out in the last few years. Those are really the two big recent iconoclasms I could find. And they're both highly, highly conscious of the internet. You know, that is the thing. For whatever reason, it seems as if people, once they became immersed, especially in a world of short sensational videos, that seems like it's the tipping point where people realized that just a quick shocking action on video could really get your message out, right? And also ISIS, I should mention ISIS or ISIL as well, used similar tactics. And it's remarkable, I think, how we have these vivid images now of the destruction of the Buddhas, you know, ISIL. And they've sort of harnessed this power of new media in a way that really didn't happen, as far as I can find, for the previous 100 years.
Samuel, I found it really surprising that the people who tend to engage in acts of iconoclasm are not the least privileged in any given society. Why would those who maybe have designs on elitism themselves be the ones to lead these efforts?
Well, they're trying to lay an ideological groundwork, you know, much like the people who put statues up in the first place. Iconoclasts very similarly invest great importance in symbols and images, and they're trying to lay the groundwork for a kind of new order or an adjusted, reformed order in which they have an important place. And I think that, you know, firstly, when I looked through the historical examples, this was something I didn't really expect at first either, but I had to piece it together that there's a real contrast between sort of aspirant elites, you know, rising classes, and the real, you know, bottom bedrock of society, the most deprived. And it's the people who are sort of in the middle and trying to climb their way up. Those are the ones who attack images. And the great contrast that I found that was so clarifying was in the Protestant Reformation, where I looked at, there was a wave of iconoclasm where people tore into churches, tore out statues, tapestries, burned them in many places in town squares, smashed stained glass windows. And a lot of that was about sort of trying to assert their control over worship as kind of middle class educated burghers, as opposed to the clergy, right? This sort of older traditional sacral elite and their sacral powers. And then I compared that and I thought, well, what about the Peasants' War? What about this huge peasant rebellion that broke out in Germany right on the heels of the Reformation? I found no reference. I scoured, I found no reference at all to attacking images. They didn't care. They were demanding tax relief. They were demanding fair judicial trials and the abolition of serfdom. They had material concerns they were worried about. They didn't bother with this sort of ideological war over symbols and images. And I found that that was clarifying then, looking at American examples and looking at recent examples. This is. It's an ideological contest with different philosophies and worldviews contending with one another. Although I would say that the old worldview that most of these statues represent is already really quite stale and doesn't have much purchase today anymore. And like as usually is the case with most iconoclasms, we're in a society in crisis and it's unclear what our beliefs are, and there's very little consensus. So you have this rising elite of largely college students and college graduates. And that's really where this struggle began. It started with debates about removing statues on college campuses in the 2010s. And then it gradually spread out and culminated in 2020. And what you have is a new kind of rising middle class with a certain philosophy and also a certain frustration, a sense that they do not have the sort of opportunities and the sort of status that they were led to expect. And I think this iconoclasm is a way for them to sort of assert themselves.
So, do these iconoclasts, though, believe that they are speaking for the most oppressed among us?
Well, certainly many of them claim to, but and I'm not going to dispute that one way or another. I just argue that this can serve as a distraction and it can serve also as an outlet for frustrations of this class, rather than directing it at, say, lenders, landlords, employers, the people who are really, swindling and exploiting young people, rather than the ire being directed at them, it's very convenient that instead it gets directed at like a statue of Jefferson Davis, right? So I think that's a large part of why truly powerful people in America are really tolerating this iconoclasm and are not doing really anything to stop it. Because I think whether they consciously realize it or not, it's really playing to their advantage. It's sort of letting off the steam of anger and frustration in a pretty, I would say, inconsequential direction.
Okay, so yeah, elites can sort of pay lip service to these shouldn't be taken down. This is disgraceful. This is disrespectful. But this provides them cover. They don't have to change anything as long as what people are really angry about in the moment is that statue somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a college administrator, say, and you're trying to somehow manage, they often have very complex jobs where they're trying to mediate between students, parents, big donors, investors, and sort of keep this rickety ship together. If you're in that position, you're going to be so happy if people are fighting over statues. You're going to be so happy if people are fighting over renaming a building, right? This totally immaterial stuff, this purely symbolic, you could call it kind of shadow boxing between different elite factions, right? That's basically how I see it. And I think it's in line with the historical pattern. It's like, oh, the imperial administrators versus the regional gentry. Like, and it's over this purely symbolic issue. And so when I was asking myself, well, why has it come up and why is it so vehement and there's so much passion to it? I think it's because the sort of new philosophy that's coming up now, mostly among college educated people, media, no offense, I love you, is a philosophy and a worldview that really puts images and symbols at the center, that really enshrines that as sort of the most crucial terrain of struggle, and that sort of elevates people who have this special education, this semiotic training, to be able to see sort of evil or harmful influences through words and images. Right? Does this make sense?
It does.
So that's why I think, you know, despite the relative obscurity, I would say, of these images and statues, that's why I think they've attracted all this attention.
So to your point, one phenomenon that tends to accompany periods of iconoclasm is this heightened demand for purity in the form of like policing speech and individual action and what you call malign social influence. How does that play out?
Yeah, well, I was just thinking about it firstly in the current case, you know, and how there's sort of endless debate and conflict now about the correct use of words and this increasing idea that if someone says something that you find insulting, that constitutes violence, right? And this is, I think, a very important change in thought. You know, it used to be, if you go back to before 1900 or so, it used to be if someone said something that you found disrespectful, that was considered a dishonor. You know, you have an honor that attaches to your character, your role in society. And if someone doesn't show you the respect you believe you're entitled to, that's an insult. And you have the right to demand redress, right? Well, we've dropped that sort of vocabulary, right? We don't believe that there's such a thing as honor anymore. But if someone says something that you find, you know, threatening or disrespectful, you have to somehow argue that you've actually been physically hurt by it, right? It's this sort of therapeutic and medical language. And you have to claim that you said something I didn't like, so that did violence to me. And it started to sound, the more I looked at it, it started to sound more and more like this sort of almost magical thinking, right? That images and words can actually reach out and physically hurt you. And I found quotes, for example, of a student at Oxford saying, "Walking past the statue of Cecil Rhodes does violence to me." And it was almost like I had written it myself. It was like this perfect encapsulation of what I was trying to distill, that words and images can actually hurt you. And hence that justifies violence in return, right? And I don't care if someone tears down the statue of Cecil Rhodes. I say, whatever, I have no position about it. I'm not Oxford University. I don't care. But it's remarkable the lengths that people will go to sort of act out this new philosophy that the violence of images justifies actual physical acts in response. And as I looked at it, I realized that it was very reminiscent of previous iconoclastic philosophies where people imagined, you know, like for instance, the Egyptian statues, thinking that they are somehow alive and can really control you or hurt you, and you have to physically deface them to counter that. And also, more specifically in the American context, it sounds very similar to me to Puritan Jeremiads, where the Puritan ministers would preach about the sin infecting the community, the evil hidden influences of Satan, and also of the vestiges of popery, right? The vestiges of Catholic influence in the church, which had to be extirpated, particularly by destroying images, right? Any sort of lavish imagery in a church was a sign of corruption and evil. And I think that it's a really interesting echo, right? That Puritans, you know, these highly educated professionals, very learned in the Bible and theology, would preach the word, right? The pure word, and they would rail against the danger of idolatry and images. And they would argue, you know, that this was a representation of original sin. And it's really remarkable how now today, when people talk about racism, right? They might see a racist image or utterance, and they'll talk about this as America's original sin, right? This sort of inborn evil that has to be personally rooted out and destroyed. It's remarkably similar.
Samuel, it does seem, based on what you're describing, that it can create what turns into like an arms race of victimhood. I wonder if iconoclasm is a way for the somewhat privileged among us to sort of claim that they are as wounded and beleaguered and damaged as the people who are most, in the most physical, palpable ways, oppressed by societal ills.
Yeah, well, right. So, you know, and there's this phenomenon of white knighting, as it's called colloquially, sort of rushing in and presenting yourself as the protector of some putative victim. And, others have commented about sort of the victim mentality, and that's fine. That's not the particular point I'm trying to make, but it's more that when people do, I think it's great to stand up for someone who's being oppressed or persecuted. You know, I encourage that.
Sure.
But what's remarkable about today, about the present moment, is how these battles are fought on this symbolic terrain. You know, it's all about calling out a racist word or calling out a misogynistic image, right? It's all in this sort of rarefied symbolic realm where kind of everything has become a literary criticism seminar. Right. It's a lot of this pseudo-therapeutic language about triggering, about toxic masculinity. You know, it's all this sort of half-baked terminology borrowed from psychology or therapy that is then taken in to university classrooms. And then from there, it spills out into politics, into political debate. And it's this sort of, you know, half therapeutic, half literary analysis sort of language, right? And when people step in and say, I am protecting someone who is oppressed or persecuted, it's always because there's an image or a word that has this evil hidden influence that they have to uncover. And this is how they demonstrate their special powers, right? It's a lot like a diviner or a magician showing, I can see these hidden evil forces. And I used this example of from Jeopardy, where someone, you know, there was a contestant on Jeopardy. He won a few rounds, and then he made a gesture where he put his hand with three fingers extended on his chest. And then some former contestants wrote a letter saying, that's a white power gesture. And we have to explain to you how this had some evil hidden meaning, which actually harmed the viewers. It hurt them, and it's dangerous. And I was so amazed by it because I was like, wait, but nobody knows what that hand gesture is. You had to explain it to them. How did it have this evil, harmful influence? But so that's, I think, the specific dimension of the phenomenon that people haven't really taken stock of, right? People have talked about the, you know, victimhood and victimhood contests, and those are all fine points and fine observations. But I think what people have been missing is that there's no substance behind it. It's all about symbols, and it's all about sort of, you know, much like the Puritan ministers, finding the evil, hidden evil forces.
Just to make sure that everybody's clear on this, the symbol that you're describing, older folks may have grown up using that to mean okay without saying the word. And the person in question accused of doing this was not aware that the meaning had changed, used it to mean okay or all right or right on. Is that accurate?
Well, it's that sort of hand position. And he also held it on his chest with the three fingers extended. Now, I have no idea whether he had any hidden meaning to that gesture. Maybe, maybe not. I cannot see how it possibly matters. What on earth, who is going to be impacted by a dude holding out three fingers for a second on Jeopardy? It's an incredible level of obsession over the most inconsequential things, right? And so what I'm trying to say here is, I'm not going to try to read that guy's mind. I don't know what was going on in his mind, and I don't care. I don't see how it matters. You know, it's a lot like going into a park and tearing down a statue of a lady that was donated by suffragists, and nobody even knows who it represents or why it's there. It's obsession over both over images and also over this kind of folk psychoanalysis, right? This idea that there are hidden meanings and hidden ill intentions that we, the enlightened or the woke, in quotation marks, can discern.
Samuel, you mentioned that this kind of policing of thought and speech spills from the activism of iconoclasts into political discourse. Does it then extend into new political policies that actually address some of these concerns?
Well, I'm not an expert in policy, but something that I think is significant is what impactful new legislation has been passed in the past 12 years. It's really at a standstill, right? We've replaced policymaking with constant furors over symbols, right? That's the sense in which I think it has taken over the political realm, is that, and I think that the generation of people around my age, I'm in my 30s, see politics as fundamentally about fighting over language, right? And I shouldn't paint with such a broad brush. It's people of my age of a certain sort of class who essentially see politics as fighting over language and fighting over symbols. And that's whether you're liberal or conservative. And people who actually want to see policy change, like, can't get a word in, right? All the oxygen is sucked up. And also it can be used strategically. If you're a person with a certain degree of power in politics, it's very easy if someone actually comes forward with a policy idea to say, oh, well, the person who proposed that once said something bad. So therefore, they're canceled, and therefore all their ideas or proposals have to be thrown out. And it's an easy way to maintain a stalemate. And I think that that's where we are now. It's stalemate.
So you don't deny in this piece the existence or the impact of deep social ills, poverty and structural racism and white supremacy. How might a climate focused on iconoclasm actually make it harder to systematically address the suffering caused by these things?
Well, it's a good question, but there have been a lot of conversations about, in my experience, most of my friends and acquaintances tend to be in the liberal part of the political spectrum, right? In most respects, I'm more to the left than most people I know and most people in my sort of milieu. And it's remarkable how, if you say things like, we shouldn't make trade deals that devastate the industries of large parts of the country, just for instance, right? They will take that and turn it into a different kind of issue. They'll say, oh, but those people are just upset because of racial grievance. And what's remarkable about it is, like, that's not the question. The question is not whether you like people in a certain part of the country or who work in a certain industry. It's not whether you approve of their views, and it's not about what color they are. I mean, people who work in industry are all different races and colors. And yet, what happens is people take these substantive policy issues and they spin them and weave them into somehow being about identity, representation, symbols. They transmute it into something it's not. And I think that there are many people on the political left who really play into this. Even if they see themselves as more left wing, they also play into it because they'll look at something like, say, student debt, right? We've basically created a permanent debtor class, right? There's no possible way. The jobs, the income is not there for people to pay back these debts, right? So what we have in front of us is a permanent debtor class. And if you debate, well, should that debt be canceled? Even the advocates in favor of it will say, well, it's a racial justice issue because a large portion of the people who have that debt are black. Well, wait, does that mean it's only legitimate if it's a racial justice issue? Do you see what I'm saying? Is it only legitimate if you see it as a sort of symbol of these contending demographic groups and their contending statuses, rather than just a simple economic numbers issue? The debt can't be paid back.
If these things tend to play out in a predictable pattern, that would suggest that periods of iconoclasm wax and wane over time. What does it look like when a society sort of climbs out of this a bit and maybe does address in a more practical fashion these things that many people agree are problems?
Well, it's interesting how if you look at aesthetics today, aesthetic tastes are very divided, but people who sort of, well, really most people, regardless of where they are, where they see themselves on the class hierarchy or, the political spectrum, people all always have retro tastes, right? It's like if you are a leftist, a Jacobin reader, you're sort of into like Bauhaus retro futurism, right? Or if you're conservative, you have this sort of nostalgic kind of Frank Capra or Thomas Kincaid sort of sentimentalism, which is all fine. It's all fine. I'm not against any of it, to each his own. But there's an amazing lack of a new vision, right? There's really. And I am definitely one who subscribes, and I have combed through lots of history. I mean, I hope that comes across. I really subscribe to the argument that aesthetic and artistic innovation and, fashion, clothing, cuisine has really halted over about the past 25 years. There's been very little innovation. We seem to be kind of stuck around 1997. And when people look for something of high taste, they're looking back. They're looking back to the 70s or the 50s or the 30s. And I think that it's, I can't predict the future. I don't know what the future holds. But I do think that if there's going to be any kind of reunion, if there's going to be any sort of new consensus, it has to come with some sort of new vision of what is beautiful and what is inspiring, and when we think of the New Deal in the 30s, there's a certain aesthetic, these monumental bridges and there's kind of late Art Deco sort of dramatic monumentalism. And new political movements, if you think of progressive reform in the early 1900s, it came with this colonial revival and arts and crafts. And I think that there has to be some sort of new belief system that for one thing speaks to people materially, that actually speaks to like their needs, how they're getting food on the table, and also that has something inspiring, has some sense of beauty and of a more beautiful future. I just don't know what that is. And I think that it's going to take a while, to get past this sort of this kind of whirlpool we're in of just, fighting over imaginary, spectral dangers.
Is there something about our particular sort of romantic attachment to being individuals in this country? I mean, of course, we're part of a society and we're shaped by the forces around us and the people around us, but we all want to be like superstars. Is there something about the American way of defining identity that makes it harder to get to these moments when something truly new emerges from one specific place?
Yeah, I think that is a factor. I think that, but it's these things are very complicated. I mean, on the one hand, Americans are quite distinct in a lot of ways, and we love self-reliance. We always have. I think it's been right now we're in a crisis partly because that sense of self-reliance and independence has been even more inculcated at a time when it's really practically less and less feasible. There just aren't the kind of wages and incomes and cheap housing for people to be independent. So we're sort of setting people up for failure. And there is a kind of common fear or anxiety in America that you are in danger if you rely on others or even if you cooperate with others. And I just read recently about this interesting study about people with schizophrenia in different societies. And they looked at people in India and in Africa and in the US. And in other countries, people have schizophrenia and it can be a problem. It's difficult. But often they report a lot of positive interactions with the voices in their head, right? They often see them as sort of guiding them or having a sense of humor. They can have a kind of fun time talking with these entities that they hear in their head. Whereas in the United States, people with schizophrenia always experience the voices as hostile and as an invasion of their person. And I think it speaks to how we're sort of trained in America to think of others as threats and to be afraid and to want complete self-control and complete independence, which, America is different from other countries. That's fine. I don't reject that. But I think we really have pushed it to an extreme, to the point that, our politics are just kind of constant paranoia and constant. And now it's almost like everyone is schizophrenic in a way. No offense to people with schizophrenia, but we've gotten to this point where it's like everyone is afraid of hearing something hostile, right? Or seeing a hostile image, right? That's coming to attack us. It's like these particular American manias are sort of coming to a boiling point.
Do you have any sense, Samuel, of how we could build a culture that brings people together to fix things? I mean, when I think about the left and the right and the things we argue about, sometimes we're afraid of the same things, right? Like everybody's afraid of getting shot. There are just really different approaches to how we fix that. Everybody's afraid of losing their jobs. Everybody's afraid of not having enough when they retire. How do we sort of figure out the ways in which we can actually collaborate to solve these problems rather than insisting that our way of defining them is the only way?
Yeah, well, that's kind of the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think it's like, how do you climb out of the quicksand? And I don't have easy answers, but I do think that's something we have to recognize. When I went about writing this piece, trying to understand why are we up in arms about statues, I had to look at the different social groups and what their experiences are and what their interests are. Who is influencing them, what are their goals, their aspirations, and try to puzzle it out. And I think that today we live in a society with highly, highly concentrated wealth. I mean, most people in America, frankly, are poor by the standards of 30 or 40 years ago. They're treading water. They don't have time to think about these grand visions of society. And then, meanwhile, there are other people who have more money than they know what to do with and are perfectly happy to drop it into foundations, scholarships, and can exercise tremendous influence. And, of course, I'm in danger here of sounding like exactly the sort of paranoid analyst that I'm talking about. But I just think one has to be realistic. And I found this really interesting instance that came up of a student who was at the University of Cape Town in South Africa, and he led the campaign to take down the Cecil Rhodes statue there in Cape Town. And then he got a Rhodes Scholarship to go to Oxford, which was endowed by Cecil Rhodes. And it's almost like we can't see the irony of our own situation, and we can't see how easily we can make these sort of gestures of rebellion and resistance and then just be easily bought off. In this case, literally with some money and some institutional prestige. And he, again, no offense to the guy, I respect his decisions, but this is something I think is happening to all of us all the time, that most of us are struggling, we feel really insecure, and there are people with a lot of money and a lot of institutional power who will play to our feeling of insecurity and will play to our needs for affirmation.
Historian Samuel Biagetti is host of the podcast Historiansplaining and author of the American Affairs essay Iconoclasm of the Vanities: Why We Are Destroying Statues. Samuel, thanks very much for making time for us.
Thank you. It's like been a pleasure.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. And if you want the podcast, get it wherever you get your podcasts. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.